Welcome on to a Sunday night edition of the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. The Warriors take the pivotal, that's what you're supposed to say after every NBA Finals game, pivotal game 5, 104-91. Danny was sitting right next to me at Oracle. How are you doing, man?
I'm doing well. I'm amazed. I think this is a place to start. I'm amazed that the Warriors keep on winning games that they play all right in, but that they don't play their best game.
Why would you say they didn't play their best game in this one?
The offensive execution for the first three quarters was a little bit flawed. They had 9 turnovers in the first, I believe, in the first half. And it wasn't like they played badly. You know, I'm not saying that. I'm not saying, oh, they triumphed just by playing badly. I've seen this team play so much better.
I thought it was going to be big, big trouble for the Cavaliers because that Warriors defense, when they went up 8-2, it looked like the Cavaliers were never going to score again. And They went to double-teaming Mozgov. That was something that I had advocated for because when you get a guy like that, Mozgov had been very effective posting right up underneath the rim, but he's not used to getting double-teamed. And getting double-teamed and knowing what to do with it and knowing where everyone is a skill that takes lots and lots and lots of practice in the NBA. And guess what? No one had ever double teamed him before. So now that they did that, he had 2 really ugly turnovers and it felt like they just couldn't get anything going at all. Offensively, they tried to run some other elements. And so Blatt took him out and that actually got them back in the game. He deserves a lot of credit for that after taking out the guy who had 28 points the game before, even though he was wrongly crucified by a lot of media after the game for that.
Yeah, he wasn't playing that great. I would have given him maybe more of a chance to redeem himself, but that strategy was working gangbusters on him, and it makes complete sense that it would. And the guy I compared it to was Dwight Howard, but the big difference is that Dwight Howard has been handling that for a long time, and Mozgov hadn't. This was more like what happened when Dwight started getting doubled earlier in his career. And it was remarkable how effective it was, though in hindsight, it makes complete sense.
Yeah. No, it's really being double-teamed is hard, especially the Warriors have just such active hands. They can recover so quickly. I mean, even if he's going to avoid turning it over, you're double-teaming in a way that's going to leave the one pass that's really open way on the backside. It just takes so much effort and skill to know that that's where the pass is going to be open and not panic when you have 4 hands pawing at the ball like that. So that whole post-up thing was taken out very early on, and then it looked like they were going to kind of get run out of the gym. The Warriors did not score well very early on, but they had some bad turnovers, and it seemed like they were getting whatever they wanted early. So kudos to Blatt for making that change and keeping them in the game with what ultimately was a desperation strategy, but it was better than getting blown out to start with.
Yeah, and it also, Mozgov struggling, obviously he's dealt with that a lot less than the player I'm about to talk about, but it made me appreciate LeBron James even more than I already do, which is kind of insane considering it. But the way that he is able to make the difficult pass, and he did a lot of that in this game, is really incredible. And it's something that I think it gets talked about, but I think that sometimes we don't appreciate it for the rare thing that it is.
Yeah, he was, as has happened in a lot of games in this series, he was awesome in the first half. And then his efficiency kind of began to wear down a little bit. You know, really not through much fault of his own. Certainly I was among those who hoped for them to diversify their offense more, but when I was calling for that, that's when they had Kyrie and they had Kevin Love on the team. Now it is very clear that they basically have 2 guys in Shumpert and Dellavedova who are playing at nearly all times who can't do anything at all to create their own shot. Same thing with James Jones. Thompson, maybe you could go to him if you're desperate in the post and he might be able to do something. But, you know, certainly not even a top 3 offensive option on any kind of a good team. Mozgov was taken completely out of the game. JR, got going early. That was key to their comeback in that first quarter, but he was just getting open on pin downs, which Klay Thompson wasn't sticking with him on. So the Warriors just started switching that in the second quarter and JR was done. I mean, there's nothing else left. at that point. There really isn't. I mean, what else is he supposed to do?
Yeah, I mean, Blatt's put in a hard spot. I mean, it was also, they got 13 good minutes from Mike Miller, which was shocking. I mean, the Blatt, I think, it was. I got into a little bit of an argument on Twitter with some people. I thought Blatt has done a really good job in this series, and I was...
Excellent.
I haven't been...
Which ways about it?
Yeah. And his defensive schemes have been really good. And yeah, you can say, oh, the bad defensive players got largely thinned out of his rotation, which is true. But the scheming that they've done, they've made the Warriors work harder for what they've gotten than any team this season.
Yeah, it's pretty much, I think that's right. Although ultimately the Warriors did end up with a fairly efficient game. They had 104 points on, by estimated 95 possessions. I wasn't able to quite get the data downloaded, but that's the estimate, is 95 possessions. So it ended up being an efficient game, but that was after they exploded in that fourth quarter. And LeBron really, throughout the first three quarters, was able to drag this team to a point per possession. They ultimately ended up not that high. So, this is an interesting question. Not sure I have a good answer for it yet. Who do you think played better tonight, LeBron or Stephen Curry?
Yeah, you're right. It is a really tough question. I think that LeBron probably played better, but that's because I grade him on a curve because he had so much more to do. He's the alpha and the omega with his offense. While Steph is very close, you and I have talked about this before, I think Steph's importance to the Warriors' offense is underappreciated. But the other thing that he provided, particularly once they let Mozgov, is that LeBron was their primary, was maybe not their primary, but was close to their primary rim protector too. And so he had a very different role. He was asked to do a whole lot. But this was the closest this question has been the entire series so far.
Yeah, I think so. Well, I mean, LeBron was really inefficient in game four, so I think we got to look back at that. But, I think, though, I ultimately would probably agree with you. I mean, we do have to realize that Cleveland overall has not been very effective offensively in this series. They don't have the horses necessarily, sure, but LeBron, has not been able to push them over a point per possession, I think, in any game except for one. Which was game three. And, that's basically worst in the league level offense. This is the best defense in the league that he's playing against. But yeah, I mean, if he wasn't doing it, it wasn't getting done in this game. And he had 11 assists, 15 made field goals. So that's 26 of their 32 field goals that he either scored or assisted.
Yeah, it's really incredible. And the other component of that is how poorly they have played when he hasn't been on the floor. Granted, he hasn't missed much time. He's missed 22 minutes so far in the series. But Cleveland's offensive rating in those 22 minutes is 54.6 points per 100 possessions. That's almost inconceivable.
Yeah, and that's even buoyed by having some modicum of success with Kyrie in game one.
Correct.
So, I mean, yeah, they really have just been not being able to get anything going. And this Warriors team, against most defenses, even if you have, pretty mediocre talent, you can run a pick and roll and try to get some kind of an opening, some kind of a shot, but the Warriors will just switch everything. And now you're just going one-on-one, and you're Dellavedova, you're Shumpert, JR maybe could create a shot better in his younger days, but he's 30 now. Basically, all he's got in a one-on-one situation is to step back to his left. Once they took that away, he can't really create a shot either. There's just nothing else. There really is nothing else. I mean, you think about it, right? Like, you say, okay, LeBron James can run a pick and roll on one side of the floor, bend the defense to him a little bit, or he can penetrate and then kick out. If the Cavs shooters don't have a wide open three, they can't do anything. I mean, like, they're not, none of those guys are going to be able to attack a closeout. Really, really rough for them. Not good.
Yeah, it's just a struggle. And so in the four games without Kyrie, their offensive rating with LeBron out in 15 minutes then is 56.4, so not a whole heck of a lot better. And the other on-off...
15 minutes in four games, that's unbelievable. He sat out, 26 seconds in the first half?
Yeah, 26 seconds at the end of the first quarter. And so the net rating is also ridiculous. Before we get off this point, so something that I talked about kind of as a pet theory as this series began was that I thought that it would be similar to the Rocket series in that the Cavs would play the Warriors even, and that when LeBron was on the court and then get slaughtered with him off. Not the boldest prediction in the world, but it's still been true. They've been -8 in net rating, so 8 points per 100 possessions with LeBron on the court, which is a little bit worse, though I would mention that includes that overtime period when the Warriors just stomped them. And with LeBron on the bench, the Warrior in that whopping 22 minutes, they've been outscored by 39.2 points per 100 possessions, which is comical.
That's bad.
Real bad. Not great, Bob. Ethan already got to that. Crap, I can't say it again.
Yeah, no, I went for the Simpsons reference there instead. Anyway, before we devolve into useless referencing here, I do want to talk a little bit about Curry's game, though.
Yes.
Because I do think that his role in Golden State's offense is so much larger than what a lot of people perceive. There's really, especially since they've just been taking Clay pretty much out of it. He was 5 out of 14, but they've just been completely face guarding him. I mean, if you see the way that they're defending Clay on a couple of those Curry step backs when he's on the right wing, Clay is like 4 feet away from him, and Shumpert is just not even moving a single step towards Curry. You know, so like they are just totally face guarding Clay. So at the very least, Curry has that to his advantage, that you're basically playing 4-on-4 at all times because of what Clay's influence is. But pretty much every time that he's getting the ball in pick and roll, he starts the play and he's getting now this really a 3-on-2 almost once they put two on the ball with Green, Barnes, and Iguodala. And those guys can score that way. So he's creating his own offense as well in these ISO situations, or when he splits the pick and roll. So it's really like pretty much every play in the fourth quarter was being created by his influence, getting two guys on the ball. And, you know, Golden State doesn't really have anyone else to create a shot either. It's just that the Cavs can't switch the way Golden State does on the pick and rolls, because then Curry is just going to kill whatever big is on him.
Yeah, that's a huge point, and it gives them such an advantage, and it was in direct juxtaposition tonight with the way that the Warriors defended every Cavalier, which was basically they would help off them whether the help was needed or not. I mean, there were a couple times with Barbosa where it kind of seemed like phantom help, where he kind of goes towards there and then just ends up stuck in no man's land. But the Warriors feel that they can scramble and figure it out, and the Cavs do that with everybody else, but they aren't doing that at all with Steph and Clay.
Yeah, that's true. And we should also talk about how much Curry has improved over the last 2 years.
Mm-hmm.
Before he got injured in that San Antonio series in 2013, he really actually had trouble scoring against bigs when he switched off. Like Boris Diaw actually had some pretty good success on him. And that was a concern about whether he could create his own shot. He's worked on that and worked on it and worked on it. And he probably now is at the point where he is the single player in the NBA that you don't want to switch a big on, like that you least want to switch a big on. I mean, I can't think of anyone else besides him.
Yeah, I mean, instinctively, I think Kyrie does a good job in those situations too, off the top of my head. But he's in that conversation. The other thing that he's gotten so much better at, and we saw a lot of it in this game, was getting double covered and getting trapped, because he talked about it at the beginning of the year that was something he worked on this past summer, because the Clippers had done a few things to him that caused a lot of trouble in last year's series that they got eliminated in the first round. And those have made him such a tough cover, as tough as he already was, because they took away some of the ways that a defense can choose to handle him, and they basically made it kind of, in a way, a no-win situation.
And so just very briefly, I'm going to go through the possessions that he had basically to win the game for Golden State when it was 85-84. First, it was Green free throws when they doubled him on the pick and roll. Then Andre got a wide open corner three off another double on a pick and roll that Green found him in the corner. Then he stole an entry pass by Shumpert. He got the free throw offensive rebound, although they missed a three on that play. Barnes also was unbelievable on the offensive glass in the fourth quarter. Then Curry had split the pick and roll and had an easy layup. Then he had that ridiculous step back on Delly to go up by 10. And then he had that like 33 footer to totally ice it. So every bucket that they got from when it was a 1 point game with 5 minutes left, he directly caused. And they scored extremely efficiently outside of when they're intentionally fouling Andre.
Yeah, which was another, I don't know if it's a storyline, but was another factor in this game. I mean, it stayed somewhat close, partially because he missed, did he miss 6 out of 6 or no, 5 out of 6? He made the last one of the 6.
Yeah, after Barnes heroically got him another offensive rebound so he could
split the last one.
Missing 4 in a row. But yeah, I mean, especially considering how small the Cavs were at that point. I mean, we can get into whether the Andre thing, when we start to preview the next game, whether that hacking of Andre is something. We got a few questions on that, and we'll do some questions tonight. I mean, we've seen now the Warriors, other than in game 2, basically killing the Cavs every fourth quarter. Basically, you just would have to conclude that it's fatigue ultimately.
Yeah, it definitely seems that way. Also, the Warriors are a team that throughout games, generally in the playoffs, and a lot of this is depth related, they've had a lot of rough first and second quarters. This was true in the Memphis series. It was true to a point in the New Orleans series. It was definitely true in the Rockets series a couple times. So I think they do work themselves into a better game. Especially, they used to, in the early part of the season, they were blowing teams out in the first quarter a lot. There were games that I would joke, you know, they had at least 2 quarters of garbage time. But in the playoffs, they haven't done that as much. But they haven't needed to because they've been so much fresher in the fourth quarter. And I mean, when you think about what this Cleveland team is trying to do, it makes complete sense that they would be gassed then. They're running, not only are they running narrow rotations, but the way that they have to win games in this series is so much more demanding on them, both from a hustle perspective, if you want to think about that, but also from a mental perspective, because their schemes are different than what they've done all year and are very demanding in a way that the Warriors aren't because of their flexibility defensively.
Brian Windhorst of ESPN likes to talk about margin for error a lot, and James was asked in the post-game presser, like, realistically, what else can you do? And he said, well, you know, I gave up a bunch of offensive rebounds. Like, I had two turnovers, which is a comically low amount considering the amount of offense that he's creating. But, you know, he almost had to rack his brain to think of, like, what else he could be doing. And granted, you know, he definitely ran out of gas. He could have gotten some offensive or gotten more defensive rebounds, boxed out Barnes better, protected the basket a little better in the fourth. But, I mean, that's just, it's too much to ask of a guy. There's no way to expect anything else out of him, realistically. And, you know, I do. I was thinking about maybe being a contrarian and saying Steph played better. I think when you really think about just how bad all the rest of these players are, and Thompson actually played well. He did better finding those cracks in the defense, like we've talked about in some previous podcasts. When LeBron drives for dump-offs, he was able to score pretty well on those. But aside from that, I mean, everyone else just provided nothing. Dellavedova, just such a massive offensive liability at this point.
Yeah, isn't it amazing how that narrative changed and how over just a couple days?
Well, it never really changed for me. But
well, yeah, I
a big for some other people, yeah.
As a common reference, if I'm referring to the narrative, I'm generally not referring to you, and hopefully not to me, because I hope and feel like we get sucked into that a little bit less. And I mean, with Dellavedova, we knew his game relatively well. I mean, it was just, he did play better. I mean, you know, he had that stretch, but when a guy has a game like his, I believe was game 2 or game 3, that was so ridiculous. I mean, you appreciate it for what it is, but you don't think that is what he is now.
No, and while I may seem to be a little bit too derogatory of him, he's been fantastic defensively in the series. I mean, and LeBron said it also in the post-game presser, how many of these shots that Steph got were open? I mean, he maybe got 2 open 3. I think he had 3 open 3s. One of them was that he made, I think, was off like a scramble situation after there was a loose ball. And then he got 1 off the ball, and then there was another one when Barnes got an offensive rebound in the fourth quarter on that possession where they got like 3 threes and couldn't make any of them. You know, so that's like 3 of his shots I felt like were open. The rest of them are tough, tough shots off the dribble. He's right there. He's pretty much shut down his off the ball game. They had to just go pick and roll every time. But you know, Steph's just that good.
Yeah, and Dellavedova, yeah, his defensive role has been nice. And plus, Deli drew that nice double foul on Draymond Green.
Yeah, we're not getting into that. It really is remarkable how the two things that can reliably generate the most retweets are any commentary about the referees and any commentary about, like, perceived dirty play or something like that. Like, that is what people seem to be most interested in. For whatever reason, it gets the blood a boil.
So you're willing to do a Knicks off-season review for that, but you're not willing to talk about that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it's yeah. And this is what I'll say. This is what I tweeted, that there's pretty much one player who does something like that every game. And now there's always an excuse, right? But eventually it just gets to be kind of boy who cried wolf with this guy, right? Like, if you're doing something that opposing players are taking exception to every single game, at that, like, there's no question anymore. Like, he's doing things that are wrong on the court that he shouldn't be doing, and that, you know, the league needs to take a little bit harder of a look at. You know, it's something every single game. And that's not to take away from what he has done as an actual player defensively and with his hustle. I really respect those aspects of his game. I do not respect the plays in which he hurts people or dangerously comes close to hurting people in a way that no other player in the league does.
Yeah, the way that I phrase it, I'm somebody who grew up playing soccer as opposed to basketball, mostly because of my height, because we're not all Nate Duncans. And what I think about with plays like this, and I'm not going to say whether it was dirty or not, is if a teammate of mine did that, would I be angry? And in the context of tonight's, I would be, because that's the type of thing that can be dangerous. It can be problematic, and it just, some of them are different, but I worry this one wasn't reckless, which is part of the reason why it bothered me a little bit more. It wasn't, you know, it was definitely aggressive. He was trying to do something, but...
Well, it's the same pattern every time. And what that pattern is that he sticks his nose in there, and then if he gets knocked down, he gets angry, and he does something retaliatory.
Yeah.
That's what happens on all of these. And it's just like, it's not acceptable.
Yeah, and we'll move on from that. One of the amazing developments of this game for me, beyond the fast breakpoint disparity, where Cleveland got only 3 fast breakpoints, none of which were on made field goals, which is pretty amazing, they were on free throws, was that the offensive rebounding, particularly provided by Harrison Barnes, and that the Warriors, for I believe the first time in the series, actually won the second chance point battle.
Yeah, Barnes 6 offensive rebounds, and that was just the result of being fresher, I think. And Seth and I talked about how effective a guy can be crashing in from the wing the way he was. Although he was playing a lot too in the dunker position. He had a couple of nice screens to free up corner threes as well on penetration. But yeah, I think that yet another symptom of the Cavs running out of gas. I mean, what did Barnes have? 4 offensive rebounds just in the fourth quarter alone?
That sounds right. And another Harrison Barnes stat in this game, I could spend probably 10, 15 minutes talking about his game today. It was just kind of crazy just how it worked out. But he only had 13 touches. He had 6 offensive rebounds, I believe, total, and he had 7 shots, and he had 13 touches.
It's remarkable. And Clay had, like, some comically low amount too, right?
Yeah, Clay had 27. But Clay also, I believe he took 14 shots. So, I mean, that's...
that's about right for him.
Yeah. He's an elite catch-and-shoot player.
Yeah, he had a couple of nice looks in this game. But yeah, absolutely. I think that kind of puts into stark relief, like, how big of a role Curry really is playing. And, you know, Green plays a huge role too, but Green is only really... He's not effective going one-on-one. He's effective attacking after Curry has gotten two on the ball.
Yeah, I mean, all those guys. Andre is more involved in it. But basically every guy that the Warriors have, other than Livingston and Curry, basically thrives on the space that he creates, which is remarkable when you think about how good this team has been. And people have done some great analysis about how the... I think Ben Golliver was one of the people that I thought his work on this was very good about. Oh, and Mike Pareda, about taking away, you know, what the Warriors do well. But this team is so heavily reliant on Curry. But as we talked about earlier, what makes him so special is that as much as you can key on him, is eventually he'll figure it out.
Yeah, so another thing, we've been talking about James, how good he was. I got to say, though, if you're saying that this is the best that he's ever played, you have not a good enough memory.
Correct.
Because you have to go back to 2012, you go back to 2009 against the Magic in a losing effort, when he basically averaged 37 points. He basically averaged a triple-double with 37 points and really good efficiency, which he hasn't had in this series. And so, yeah, I mean, if you put that LeBron in this series, then this series might be, you know, Cleveland leading, because you see it. He's just not the same player that he was a few years ago. And that's not to diminish what he is now. He's probably still the best. But, you know, Andre Iguodala cuts him off basically every time he tries to drive.
Yeah.
You know, he can't blow by Andre anymore.
And also, 2012 LeBron would probably be on Steph Curry. And was a much better defensive player than he is now. Not to say much better doesn't mean that he's bad now. It just means that he was in the conversation for best defensive players in the league then, and he is not now.
Yeah, no, that's true too. You know, he certainly 2012 LeBron had a little more help, of course. But yeah, I mean, and even that Cleveland LeBron too. That's one thing, is that he just doesn't have the burst to blow by guys. I mean, if you compare the way Iguodala guarded him. I want to say it was 2011 when the Sixers played the Heat, and the way Andre guarded him then versus now, you know, both the guys have aged probably pretty much the same. They're just about the same age. Andre is much, much more effective on him now than he was back then. And the other thing is that James just misses a lot of layups that he didn't used to. You know, I mean, he used to be 75%. At the rim, and within 8 feet tonight, he was 6 out of 16, had some really critical missed layups in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, one other, you've talked about missed layups. I thought I'd bring up David Lee, because there were another couple of those tonight. It's another potential. There are two things that I think, beyond the other components about how great LeBron is and how the Cavs do have, they can play better than they played tonight, is that I feel like Kerr gave too many minutes to David Lee and Leandro Barbosa in this one.
Well, I was going to ask you, that was going to be my last question before we get to the listener questions, was Barbosa statistically had a very nice game. He had 13 points, 4 of 5 from the field, 4 of 4 from the line, so 13 points on 7 shooting possessions. That's fantastic. You know, he started off in the negative with his first stint and then actually got all the way up to the positive with his second half minutes. So do I owe Kerr a mea culpa for saying he's playing Barbosa too much? Or
no. Because on defense, he creates a lot of open looks for the opposition. We've talked about how Cleveland doesn't have a ton of guys who can create for themselves or for other people other than LeBron James. And I counted at least 3, and I haven't gone back to watch the film, so this is just watching the game and just whining about it, that Barbosa left his guy, but not to do anything. You know, like, there are reasons that you can, you know, you get caught in a screen, you can do something like that, where he was conceptually, I guess, helping, but he didn't get anywhere to help. And then LeBron, it was primarily, I think 2 of the 3 at least were LeBron. Just, he had a guy, generally, I think it was Amon, one time I think it was
it's always LeBron. We could just...
No, I'm talking about who hit the open shot. It was Amon, twice, and I think it was JR the third time.
Yeah.
And they were just... They just got wide open corner threes, and not only do you deal then with, you know, the fact that they got this look, but that can be the type of thing that can get those guys going. I mean, they can be rhythm, especially JR, can be a rhythm-based player. And so we talked about how LeBron struggled at the rim, and you're not affecting him at all. All you're doing is giving him an out, and he's going to see it. That's what makes LeBron so special in this league, is that if you give him an opening, he's going to find it. And so if you make it easy for him, he's just going to kill you every time. And it was frustrating to me, as it always is, to see teams give that to him, because he'll take it every time.
Yeah, I agree. But I think when he was that efficient, it's hard to, to especially with the second unit, it's hard to point to a few defensive lapses and say that if you score with that level of efficiency, it's hard to say unless they hit a three every time down on him. I think at least for this game, it paid off. Yeah. Maybe it's not the right decision from a process standpoint, but for this game at least, he played well.
Yeah, I think that's definitely a fair way to put it. I mean, even with those things, especially considering how the Warriors have struggled for certain stretches offensively, if you can get that from him, especially if you get it from him when Curry's off the floor, I think some of his, I would have to go back and look, but I think some of his more successful spurts were with Curry on the floor, which I think is a little bit less of a quality use of him, but, that's fine. And it was also funny because we think about how Coach Kerr described him at one point as a much improved defensive player, and he, I would say, is, but he still has a long way to go, I guess, if you want to phrase it that way.
All right, you ready to get into some questions?
Absolutely.
Okay, let's start with Thomas Richards at _TGR. LeBron MVP even if they lose? And are the Cavs title favorites next year with Kyrie and Love? I assume that Love stays. LeBron MVP for you. Well, let's start as of right now. Is he the MVP for you right now?
Yes. Because to me, I take most valuable player very by the book, and I believe that he has provided the most value to his team.
Yeah, I don't think you can argue with that. Maybe if Curry had had a good game in game two, then you might be able to start to make the argument. But I don't think so. I mean, LeBron has been pretty ridiculous. And while I do sort of eschew counting stats in favor of efficiency a lot of times, as we saw tonight, there's just no other option. And he's doing everything that they can. And when you see how terrible they've been during the rare times that he's been off the floor, I think you can't but reach any other conclusion than that. Now, let's say they lose the series in six. He has kind of a game that's good, but maybe not as good as as his good games in the series. Then maybe you got to think about it. It kind of depends what Curry does. I mean, Curry to me is the only other realistic component of this.
Yeah, I mean, Iguodala has been a very good player in the series, but most valuable is not really what he has been. I mean, Curry is more important to their offense, and while Andre has been very good defensively, which is just tells you how amazing LeBron is. We just talked about how he's, this isn't the best LeBron, and yet him scoring 40 points with a basically infinite usage rate is still a good defensive job by Iguodala.
All right, this one is from a guy has actually been a great Twitter follower of mine going back to the Basketball Insiders days, Greg at GoChaida. Where does this Warriors team rank on LeBron finals opponents? Windhorse implied LBJ thought it was the worst. I didn't see that where that was, but we'll take Greg for his word for that. So what do you think? So we've got, let's go through the list here. We've got the 07 Spurs. We've got 2011 Mavericks. 2012 Thunder, and then 13 and 14 Spurs.
I think that they're definitely, it's crazy to say this because they lost that series, but I think they're definitely above the Mavericks. Well, first of all, I'll say the best of those teams is probably the Spurs team last year. I mean, especially the way that they walloped that Heat team. In terms of the other ones, I probably would have this Warriors team second. But it gets complicated because the Warriors haven't, to me, they haven't played as well in this series as they did even in the regular season.
Yeah, I would agree with you. And I think that this Cavs team with their defense, if LeBron does in fact think that, he may be giving shorter shrift to his own teammates than perhaps they deserve due to what they've been able to do defensively. Maybe even from a coaching perspective too. But I think actually, we should not give that 07 Spurs team short shrift. That was a nasty team. That was
they were
prime Tim Duncan, prime Tony Parker, prime Manu Ginobili, and they still had Bruce Bowen defensively.
Steven Jackson?
No, Steven Jackson was on their 03 team.
That's right.
That was a really, really good team. I mean, they won, I think, only 59 games in the regular season. But if I remember, Hollinger was tooting their horn as the favorites over the Mavericks all during the regular season because they just had such an amazing point differential. They were just pretty unlucky. They actually had a better point differential than those 67-win Mavericks, as I recall, or pretty, at least pretty close to it. And, you know, because that Cavs team was, like, not really that good, and then the Mavericks had gotten upset and they beat the crap out of Utah in five in the Western Conference Finals, really the only good team they played in the – or really, you know, championship-level team they played in the playoffs that year was the Suns and beat them in that classic series with the suspensions. That team gets short shrift, but that was a nasty, nasty team.
And I also think that as much as I loved the players on that Thunder team, that team is a little bit overrated in hindsight in the sense that they have gotten so much better that we forget that at that point they weren't as good as they are now as individual components. And so they were one of those teams that we were looking at and saying, oh, wow, let's think about how great they're going to be, not how great they are now, though they obviously did go on that. They won four straight against a Spurs team that was very good.
I mean, he's played some pretty darn good teams.
Absolutely.
In the final. I mean, like that 2012 Thunder team, if they had a coach who wasn't trying to play Kendrick Perkins and having him guard Chris Bosh the whole series, maybe things are a lot different. And you also, you know, you forget too that the Thunder won game one of that series. Game four went into overtime, and then finally game five was a massive Mike Miller-fueled blowout. But yeah, I mean, I guess you would probably, just because they didn't put in that good of a showing, you have to put that Thunder team last, and then the 13 Spurs. I mean, they took a 66-win Miami team, although they were a little bit banged up, especially with Wade by the end. So I would say, I don't know, I think we're, like, in the regular season, this Warriors team is probably the best of any of those teams. I think you probably have to conclude, based on the playoffs, that they may not quite be at the level of last year's Spurs, and we haven't seen that kind of domination, and especially you would have to think that last year's Miami team is better than this year's Cleveland team. But we'll see. I mean, if the Warriors, you know, win by double figures against this Cavs team next game, you know, then you might have to think about it. They would have won three of the four games by the double figures. I think they're pretty middle of the pack as of now, just based on their playoff performance.
Yeah, one thing I wanted to bring up before we get into other questions, because I wrote it on Twitter during the day before this game, that Cleveland in Game 4, they shot 19% outside of the restricted area, and I said that was unsustainable. And in this game, they shot 33.9%. So as poor as that is, you know, to shoot outside the restricted area, that's still almost double the amount of made shots on almost an identical amount of attempts.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, 19%, that was just never going to happen again. But yeah, I mean, still, they didn't get over a point per possession, and they just got locked down pretty good in that 15-5 run from when it was 85-84. You know, they couldn't score again down the stretch. So this is a good one now from Jacob Belgum. What was Kerr's best adjustment so far? I might be biased, but I say benching Bogut.
Mine involves that, but it's not that part of it. It's starting Iguodala, because Harrison Barnes defending LeBron in the first five or so minutes of the game was not going well. And to start him and to get him in with those groupings, I think was a major adjustment that should have been made earlier, but was still the best one because it totally changed the nature of the game. I mean, today's 8-2 start never happens if Andre Iguodala is not on the floor.
Yeah, no, that's probably true. I mean, and I do think benching Bogut is very difficult. He's second team all defense. He was huge for their defense all year. And, you know, certainly a proud player as well. I mean, to go, it's one thing if you're just going to not start him. It's another thing to just essentially play him 0 minutes the last two games. He played three minutes last game, zero this game. So, you know, that takes a lot of balls. I'll give him credit for that. Certainly, but yeah, I mean, but it made sense because Bogut wasn't getting any defensive rebounds anyway. So if you're going to get killed on the boards, which they didn't really in the last two games, even, then you might as well at least get more offense on the floor while you're getting killed on the boards. And Blatt did a wonderful job, and so did their guards I mean, really what took Bogut out of the series was that the guards were playing so well, Shumpert and Dellavedova on Clay and Steph off the ball, and that just made Bogut kind of unplayable offensively. So, and then Mozgov just hanging out under the rim. So, I mean, it was great coaching by the Cavs to get Bogut out of the series, and equally great coaching by Kerr to not just keep banging his head against the wall and go with the small lineup, even though, you know, that's not really conventional. And we've talked many a time about how coaches at least always want to start conventional and try it the way it quote unquote should be. So yeah, I totally agree with Jacob. That's clearly the one. I mean, what would some of the other ones even be? You know, I was not a lot I would point to. I guess the other thing I would point to too is that they just did doing more pick and roll, especially in the second half, because, you know, against these really good defensive teams with guys who hold you off the ball, like Memphis and also Cleveland, you know, it just wasn't working, all the off-ball stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, you could say it in a more broad sense of just being more willing to play Draymond at center, but the one thing I wanted to add in, you talked about how he was second-team all-defense, and while I am far from the end-all, be-all of arbiters of this, I picked Bogut to be as my defensive player of the year. Like, that's how highly I think of him in that context, and I think that him getting a DNP CD in this game was the right decision. And that's astonishing for a healthy player.
Yeah, well, and even in Game 3, his defense was not up to snuff.
Agreed.
At all. I think there are two reasons that I would disagree with that on Bogut. I mean, one is just that I think he doesn't have the level of versatility. You know, if you go small, you can really take advantage of him. You know, because he's not someone who can get out in the pick and roll if you're playing with a shooter at the one. You know, he's lucky that he doesn't ever have to go up against Steph, because he wouldn't be able to stay on the floor against Steph in a long series. Sure. And also, I think he's just too inconsistent. I mean, at his best, he's fantastic, but, you know, he is not someone who brings that level of energy each game. And he'll have games like I thought he was actually pretty good in Game 2 defensively, but he'll have games like Game 3 where he just seems to have no energy for whatever reason.
Yeah, that's definitely fair. I have another question if you want me to go with it.
Please.
So Alexander Hitch, the Twitter handle AlexanderHitch2, asked if there are any more adjustments that Black can make in Game 6.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's really tough. One thing I was kind of pinging around slightly, but it likely is not realistic, would be to just go to a zone or even like a triangle and two type of thing, where you just put the two on Clay and Steph and just make the other guys beat you and you know, zone up to where if they set a screen on the ball, you have the guy in the zone kind of step out a little bit. But that's not something they don't even have a day to practice tomorrow. Tomorrow's a travel day. It's not realistic to implement such a crazy strategy, really, for next game. So, you know, if this were college and they had a week to prepare, you know, maybe no defensive three-second rule, maybe. So yeah, sorry for wasting your time with that idea. That's completely impractical.
It's an interesting exercise nonetheless. I'm happy you put it out there, honestly.
Yeah. Anything come to mind for you?
Yeah, I think that they should think more about playing Mozgov in the stretches. It's funny because I argued this with Bogut in the same way when the Warriors' best players aren't out, because the idea is that the Warriors did a great job executing a good idea on him in Game 5. But I feel like in those moments when the Warriors have more backups on the floor, particularly, let's say, when Steph isn't on the floor, that I'm not sure they can execute it as well. And so that gives you a little bit of a buffer. I still think he's a very good player. I think he's a great rim protector no matter what. And the Warriors, while they have a lot of strengths, their creation with those other groups isn't really there. And also, I think he would help with the offensive boards, because I think he would help stagnate those times when Curry sits. And Kerr is so dedicated, and I give him credit for this, to make sure that Curry gets his rest, that I feel like they should try to take advantage of those stretches.
Yeah, I mean, that'll probably realistically only be between 6 to 8 minutes a game. But you're right, I think Mozgov should be in at any time when Steph is not in, because then anyone else, you can just go under. You know, he can hang back in the lane. He doesn't have to run out on the floor to guard people the way, you know, he can do just fine with David Lee, who's not, doesn't have much shooting range as long as Steph is not in the game. Let's see, what else could they try? I mean, I think they might try putting LeBron on Draymond Green. And because Steph and Draymond have really, really good pick and roll chemistry. And we saw once actually where they tried to run pick and roll with Barnes, and Steph kind of lobbed it up into space the way he does for Draymond to catch it on the move when he gets doubled, and Barnes went the wrong way and they turned it over. So I think actually putting James on Green and then switching and say, all right, you know, we're going to put, James on Steph, but then that's just going to exhaust LeBron more. So that certainly has its downside as well. He's trying to do everything offensively already.
Yeah, I would seriously consider it, especially if Game 6 starts out well for the Warriors. I think that's a good idea. Also, Harrison Barnes is not exactly making anybody pay for leaving him open, which is something that you and I talked about a lot, you know, not on the air, but during this game.
Yeah, and it's so, I mean, the Warriors are just so hard because with this small lineup now, they can switch everything, and every bucket you score has to be created one-on-one now because they're switching everything, right? Usually against most teams, you can set some back screens, you can set some pin downs, you can get guys shots that way by setting picks, and just they're so good at communicating and they're all the same size that you're not getting those openings.
Yeah, it really is remarkable. Do you want to? I just think it's just a little bit. I mostly want to use this as a soapbox to talk about something myself. Renato, I'll just read the Twitter handle because the name is long. DJ Rogue Like asked if the Cavs should consider trading Kyrie and Love for quality role players. That LeBron doesn't need more than that. Something I just want to talk about with this is that I think Kyrie is an excellent fit next to LeBron. I think not only is it great for LeBron, I think it's amazing for Kyrie because he's not a true point guard in the sense of, you know, the idea of a primary ball handler creating for himself and others. And we talked about how heavy a burden LeBron has had in this series. Kyrie is one of those players who a defense has to pay attention to every second of every game. And LeBron playing with a guy like that is something that I don't think you can get from other guys. And you want to talk about role players, I think Kyrie, you could argue in a way that Kyrie could be the best role player in the league because you don't need him to be more than that all the time.
Yeah, and Love is just, it creates so many different matchup problems. Now, you know, if you want to try and imagine Kevin Love getting out on the floor and, you know, trying to guard Draymond Green in this series, it certainly would be a much crazier offensive series in both directions than it has been. But I think that the Warriors would really struggle to stop LeBron when you can't just do all this switching, which, you know, Love, it would be tough to switch someone who's smaller than Green onto him because he's not a great post guy against like-sized players, but he can definitely abuse matchups in the post who are, you know, don't have the heft that he does. And he's also an excellent passer as well, so you can't, the double team situation doesn't work on him nearly as well. And then there's the type of shooting that he provides also. So, and you know, his work on the offensive glass.
And he's a good passer.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's, I would not trade those guys, and, you know, especially since Love's a free agent.
Probably.
Yeah, you're not going to look good if he resigns there, and then you trade him anyway, and you can't even trade him until January 15th anyway. So,
the other thing I was thinking about with this, and I don't want to get too down on it because I don't mean it in that way, but I really want to see this healthy Cavs team, like with this core group of guys, make an NBA Finals because while I got frustrated with how they use Kevin Love and a lot of other things. They're a very distinct team in this league, and I would say the Warriors are too, but it would have been so much fun to see them this year, but hopefully they'll have more chances because they're a very different animal, and I think we never really got a chance to see it in the postseason, but I have this vision in my brain of how this team could look in a 7-game series, and they could just wreck teams.
Yeah, I mean, Kevin Pelton projected before the year that they could be one of the best offensive teams of all time. And I think with another year together to really get some continuity, to maybe let David Blatt's system take hold a little bit more, get some more ball movement, that they could get up to, you know, at least like number one in the league level offensively. But yeah, no, it is really a shame that we've been robbed of what would have been an awesome series, even with Kyrie being healthy. You know, I still think the Warriors would have beaten them if Kyrie were healthy. But yeah, I mean, with all three of those guys, they were the team that I felt, you know, even more so than San Antonio, that I felt the Warriors would have trouble with, because they might, that might be the one team that they would really struggle to stop, which they of course have not without Kyrie and Love. So, all right, so we got time for two more questions. Number one, does Mozgov stay nailed to the bench in Game 6? That's from Joel Hobson.
I hope not. I still think he's been their second best player in this series. And while he can definitely be more limited than he was in, let's say, Game 4, because the Warriors did a really nice thing defending him, and I don't know that he can fix it that quickly, he should play more than a little over 9 minutes.
Okay, well, so did you disagree then with Blatt's decision to play him so little in this game?
Not really. I think that, well, I disagree in the sense that I don't think they tried it enough during the off times, but I thought that he should not play much against the starters because what they did against him was devastating to Cleveland.
I mean, so let's think about it here. Was, like, did taking him out of the game really cause them to get it together? You know, I wouldn't say necessarily that it did. I mean, certainly he had some pretty hopeless turnovers, and they also were able to get it. Like, Draymond Green was able to get a ton of wide open threes, although Mozgov was early on, although Mozgov was guarding Iguodala a lot of the time. I mean, I think Andre has shot well enough to kind of get them out of that, of him guarding...
getting the Tony Allen?
Yeah. I mean, but then on the other hand, if you have him guarding Green, Bob Vilgeris was talking about this today, why not have him on Green? I think the reason for that, whether it's right or not, I don't know, is that then you're in, you got Mozgov in pick and roll every time with Green and Curry. And
right,
those are the two best guys there. So, I mean, I think it, maybe like a little, just try to get some tweaks in there with him defensively where you can leave him kind of under the rim and hopefully just like, this was something that, the Nets would do a lot where they had two bigs on the floor and they would always make sure, this was a few years ago, they'd make sure that Reggie Evans was always the guy who guarded the pick and roll, but that was against much more stagnant teams. The Warriors are playing a five-out system. You may not be able to do that approach, but that would be something to consider to keep him from having to get way out on the floor in pick and roll coverage. I actually think that he probably made the right decision with him this time because he wasn't able, like, that double teaming was going to take away all that he was providing offensively. And I think that defensively, they're probably better with him off the floor when the Warriors are going with that small lineup, except when Steph is out of the game. Because when you're putting Mozgov in pick and roll with Steph, it becomes untenable, I think.
That's also when JR went off.
Setting it, yeah.
That's also when JR went off, was in the first quarter with, you know, with that four, I guess you'd call it four out. It's kind of weird to say with LeBron and Thompson, just who counts as out and who doesn't, considering, I mean, LeBron made that 34-footer, but he's not really that kind of player right now. But, yeah, I think that they need to think about that. I need they need to consider the idea of kind of using Mozgov as more of a counter piece than as a primary piece.
Yeah, so I don't know. I definitely wouldn't start him, I don't think. But again, you know, they don't have any bodies on the wing to play small. I mean, he's still a good player. He's one of their few good players that they have. But, I mean, this is one thing that I have to get to that I was a little peeved by is people saying now that, you know, I was saying, oh, Mozgov's a relatively unskilled guy. You know, but he still did a really good job. And people said, no, he's actually, like, really skilled. No, he isn't. I totally disagree with that. I mean, like, he can kind of catch. I mean, he can robotically finish around the rim, but doesn't really have much range on his jump hook. He can make a jump shot, but, you know, it takes him an hour to get it off. And obviously his passing and, you know, passing out of a double team is certainly a skill that he doesn't have at all, and that totally neutralized him. So, yeah, I mean, I think he's, let's slow down a little bit. Like, there's a reason 28 points was his career high. Talking about him as some kind of upper echelon center in the league is far, far beyond what he actually is. It was just simply a function of the fact that the scheme was leaving him open, and they adjusted slightly, and guess what? He was off the floor, and I probably agree with the fact that he at least shouldn't be in the starting lineup anymore if they're going to go small.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the first 5 minutes of this game kind of worked as a mic drop for you on that argument. But the other the other kind of component of that is that people have trouble sometimes talking the difference between a very good player and a very skilled player. You know, those are very different things. I don't think when I interpreted what you were saying, and I agreed with you, though I wasn't, I think you said that on the podcast, I wasn't on it to agree with you, was that he's still good. I mean, there are lots of guys in this league that are that the disparity between their quality and their skill can be one way or the other. You know, that is, they are not the same thing. And I think that there should be kind of, in a way, an appreciation for that. I mean, Mozgov, he's done a great job as a rim protector. He does a lot of things well, and he does a lot of things well that are useful for a team winning. It's just that those are not things that you would generally attribute to skill, and there's nothing wrong with that.
And he's making $5 million a year, too. You know, that was a great – I mean, when people were so shocked that two first-round picks were traded for him because, you know, remember, he didn't have any kind of reputation in Denver. I think even, like, Tim Connelly was kind of made fun of for letting Costa Kufos go and re-signing Mozgov to a three-year, $15 million contract, essentially. And that actually turned out to be a great bargain, great contract by Denver, even though, you know, Mozgov and their team didn't have as much success as they wanted to. But the reason they could fetch two first-round picks for him wasn't only because of his skill, but also because he's under contract for such a bargain, and that adds value to it as well. So that was, I mean, I think it was a great trade for Denver. You know, people who are saying, oh, I can't believe they traded him away. Pretty amazing that Mozgov has played well enough that some people are saying that. But when you consider that he's in his late 20s, their timeline of, you know, they're not competing in these next couple of years, much, and he's going to be a free agent after next year, much better to just grab those picks while you could from Cleveland. So, I mean, it was a win-win trade for both sides. One of the rare times you can say that.
Also, shout out to Sam Presti for giving the Cavaliers a first-round pick for Dion Waiters they could use in that trade.
You know, I think you may have, like, some sort of programming in your brain that just requires you to, like, bring that up.
Yeah, I programming in the sense that Dion Waiters, that the Oklahoma City acquired maybe the two players who drive me the craziest in the entire league, and we might have to talk about that on a later podcast.
All right, so last question here. This is from Dan Ocho O'Connell, his Twitter handle, Ocho O'Connell. It's a pretty good handle.
I like it.
There's a browse for that. After what you saw tonight at Oracle, are you still confident the Cavs take it to 7? What do you think? I mean, you never were, I guess. But I mean, I'll ask it a different way. What do you think the chances are that this does go 7?
60%. That's where I'm at right now. I thought about it on the drive home. I think that while the Warriors have shown a lot that would lead to it, I think Cleveland is going to play their hardest. I think they're not going to do everything right, but I think they're going to do it. And while it would be disappointing to me in the sense that it would mean that you would win our prediction thing because you said 7 and I said 6, I feel I just have this. It's sometimes for me it's very frustrating because I try to be so analytical, but I just feel it. I think that the more likely outcome is that Cleveland wins Game 6.
You know, it's interesting, rather ironic. I was going to say I think there is a 51% chance that the Cavs win and take it to 7, which I think that, and I think that seventh game would kind of end up being a little bit similar to tonight, maybe with the Warriors pulling away slightly earlier. But I think in the sixth game, Cleveland did not lay down tonight at all. I thought that it was possible that. And if tonight had been a blowout, I would have felt pretty confident about the Warriors ending it. But I think Cleveland can just summon one more Herculean effort in front of their home fans. Maybe their role players can hit a few more shots. I mean, they got up a lot of three-pointers tonight, which I think is an encouraging sign. Although, I mean, JR, people talked about, you know, him shooting 4-14 ultimately. He was not getting great looks at all. I mean, he just had to jack up a lot of late clock shots, but you know, guys like Jones missed some, Shumpert missed some, Dellavedova at least can hit a couple of threes. You know, he probably, so in front of the home fans, maybe those guys will hit enough shots that they can send it back in, you know, kind of a nail biter. But, you know, I mean, 51% is about as unconfident as I can be while still picking it to happen, of course.
Yeah. And we went through all that without talking about the officiating at all.
Yeah, I didn't think there was anything too bad about the
officiating. No, but... I didn't. I just in terms of, you know, the conspiracy theorists who would say probably that the league would want a game seven.
Well, yeah, but you don't want to tell them that, like, the league paid us to not talk about the officiating. Think of how much money you just blew for us.
Hey, that would be you, not me, because I haven't seen a cent of it yet.
All right, on that note, no, the league did not pay us off to stop talking about the officiating. Okay, no, seriously, they didn't. Stop tweeting me with officiating conspiracy tweets. I ignore them. It's not actually happening. So anyway, we will be back tomorrow. Maybe get into a little more off-season stuff and maybe a little draft stuff as well. We'll have to figure that out tomorrow, prepare something for you guys. Danny, it's good to have you back. We missed you last week when you were in Cleveland. Actually, oh, no, you're not on tomorrow, are you? Because you're going to be flying.
I'm going to be in the air to game six.
All right. Well, I guess we will have a mystery guest. And it is a mystery to me, too, because I don't know who it's going to be yet. But it'll hopefully be someone. But... anyway, I'm getting a little punchy here. My day started about 24 hours ago, so time to let everyone go. This has been the Dunked On Basketball Podcast. Follow Danny at Danny LaRue on Twitter. I'm Nate Duncan, NBA. Subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. You can give us a rating, hopefully not based on these last 10 minutes of rambling or so. And we will talk to y'all next time. Thanks for listening.